I'm Bob Ryan of the Boston Globe and ESPN.
I'm Mike Lubega of the New York Daily News and SportsOnEarth.com.
And I'm Mitch Albom of the Detroit Free Press. And welcome to this edition of the Sports Reporters Podcast. We do this podcast every Monday and Friday. It lends itself very nicely in football season to wrapping up and setting up. And boy, going into this weekend, the setup for NFL games is fantastic. There's going to be some terrific playoff games to look at. But we cannot begin this podcast without looking back, even though it's 4 days ago now, to the national championship on Monday night between Alabama and Georgia that capped a fantastic college playoff season that, as Mike pointed out on our last podcast, don't fix what ain't broke. This thing is working right now, and boy, do we get great games all the way down to the last second of an overtime game. Tua, and we're getting this right all show long, Tua Tagovailoa, who did not play but meaningless minutes during the course of the season, comes in the second half, ends up throwing the winning touchdown pass, and it was a remarkable game, a remarkable move by a coach who considers to sort of outdo himself. And where does this kind of put Alabama and Nick Saban, considering the move he made at halftime, guys?
Well, he's the only coach that could, as been pointed out, could have failed and had his reputation unsullied. But this just is such an enhancer. This is overkill. This puts some, you know, it'll be high up on the list of things that people will cite when he retires or when he goes. It's clearly, I mean, who among us, first of all, show of hands. Who among this August panel knew of the existence on this earth of Tua Tagovailoa Viola before this game started?
No, and Bob, I've had a couple of conversations. Paul Feinbaum's one of my favorite people on the planet, and he's as smart about college football, and especially SEC football, as anybody I've ever known. Mm-hmm. And he said there had been some talk in the run-up to the Clemson game that he might get into the game, and Paul said he thought he saw his helmet on in the second quarter. But nobody knew about this kid, obviously, except Nick Saban. And here's the thing about Saban. Bob's right. His bona fides were in place, whatever happened last Monday night. But as Feinbaum pointed out to me yesterday, Mitch and Bob, Nick has won his two last national championships. One, because of an onsides kick against Clemson that was an extremely gutsy move at the time, and without which he might not have won that game. And then I have been trying to remember circumstances, anything like this, with stakes like these, where a coach went to a kid who had never played in a game where his team was winning by less than double digits. And after the first series, this young man looked like he was 32 years old and had played in as many big games as Brady did. And having said that, you guys tell me who he was throwing to when Ridley caught the ball for the second Alabama touchdown in the second half.
Yeah. Well, I think when you talk about Nick Saban's move here, it wasn't the confidence that he showed in this kid alone. It was his read of a football game at 13-0. This, to me, is what separates great coaches from average coaches. 13-0 doesn't seem like it's unovercomable, right? You know, it's all right. You know, the two touchdowns, we're back in it. But in his mind, he analyzed the game and said, we're not coming back the way we are. We got to do something radical here, or it's going to be 20-0, and then it's going to be too late. And I admire coaches who make those kind of preemptive moves in a game. They see things that other people don't see, and they say, hey, I know the path we're on. We got to make a switch. No coach in his right mind, I'm sorry, no coach in his right mind plays a player who has not played all year in a national championship game in the second half unless he is seeing something like, we are not going to win the way we are constructed like that. And it takes a brave coach to say that about a guy who led you know, all but to a win last year and had a fantastic season up to that point. And that's what I admire about him. Not so much Tua's performance, which was the reflection of his intelligence to make a move, but making that move in the first place.
Well, bitch, and here's the other thing. But and again, Nick did it, okay? And it took guts, and it was born out of desperation. Jalen Hurts had 21 passing yards at halftime. 21 passing yards. So we're all seeing the same game. But it was interesting to me that after the game, I saw a quote. Jimbo Fisher was at the game and once worked for Saban. And he spoke to what you just spoke to, Mitch. The feel that Saban has for the game he's watching. And we watch these coaches, and we sometimes get the idea that it's the old Bear Bryant, you know, eye in the sky, up above practice. Okay, they got an offensive coordinator. They got a defensive coordinator. But Nick Saban, with all of that and all the delegating that goes on in the modern world of football, he has his hands on this game. And he did what he had to do to win that game. And again, if you're Saban, as Bob said, you don't have to worry about the fallout because your place in history is already fixed.
Yep. Well, yeah, and who does he remind you of? Well, of course.
Yeah.
You know, and they are good friends. They did work together, and I don't even have to mention the name of the other guy. But the other guy, say this, he made the one choice, wasn't in national championship game, but he made a fateful decision many years ago that a lot of people at the time were completely perplexed by to change a quarterback. But that wasn't in the middle of a championship game, obviously. But he made a fateful quarterback decision that has turned out to look pretty good.
And can I say something else about this game? Because there were so many hosannas hurled at Kirby Smart after the game. And he did a wonderful job, and it's his second year at Georgia. And I got, I mean, it should have been a drinking game after the game if when we heard how well they're set up in the future and how great his recruiting classes are going to be. Okay, all that. Guys, Georgia did as much to lose this game as Alabama did to win this game. And they played in the second half of the biggest game of their lives the way they did kind of in the first half of the semifinals. And if Fromm doesn't throw one big 80-yard pass in the second half, they do nothing. They do nothing on offense. And let me make one other point. On second and forever in overtime, they let a guy get behind everybody and wide open so that Tua could throw him the ball.
But that was a result of the Alabama defense more than anything else, Michael. I mean, they were ridiculous. You know, they were in the backfield half the time in the second half, and it speaks to how well coached that team is, and the fact that Fromm was a freshman, and didn't we all say that before the game? Like, you know, all right, he's going to have the game of his life on the night of his life at the end of his freshman season, and maybe he's going to play like a freshman. Except that Hurts, who's the sophomore, plays worse than him, and Tango Vailoa, who's the freshman who's never played a game before, plays better than anybody. What I stand back and marvel at, and look, it's no shame to lose to Alabama, Michael. I mean, you know, it's like losing to the Patriots by a couple points. So you're the second. I do think Georgia's the second best team in college football, and they are set up for the future, but there just happens to be this group right here, who, by the way, almost didn't get in by the vote. Remember, they were number four. Ohio State arguing, "Oh, come on, us for," and we proved that wrong. But I look at, like, for, you know, listen, living out here with Michigan, who went through three quarterbacks who couldn't play the position all year long, and then you look at teams like Alabama, who have a guy like this, and I'm reading a quote from him now, just looking at a story, saying, "I don't know how Coach Saban found me all the way in Hawaii from Alabama. Thank God he found me and we're here right now." How does Nick Saban find this guy with this kind of talent that now people are saying, by the way, they've never seen anybody set up better with this kind of talent than this kid? How does he find him, sign him, have him ready to go after sitting for essentially, 12 or 13 games and step in like that? That's the difference between this program.
Well, I mean, the kid wasn't, and almost Mitch, all the kid wasn't unknown. I mean, and the thought was he went to Mariota's high school. He's a huge star there. And the thought was that he was going to follow Mariota to Oregon. And obviously, he if he was on Oregon's radar, he had to be on other people's radar. That doesn't mean that Saban gets less props for bringing him to Tuscaloosa. And Bob, you know, as Mitch is talking about backup quarterbacks, you know, thank God Alabama had a, dare I say, Jimmy Garoppolo waiting to go into the game on Monday night.
Well, you know, obviously things that separate, among the things that separate the best teams from the next best teams from the next best teams after that is depth. And up and down the lineup, and the way that these guys, these teams continually regenerate themselves. Now, it'd be interesting to see how Alabama addresses this massive defection that they're having as we speak to the NFL. So they'll do it. We know they'll do it. And
is Hurts coming back, by the way?
There's three possibilities. There's three doors here, Mitch, I think. One, he stays. He stays because, you know, listen, remember how all of the, we were ready to carry Cardell Jones around the room on our shoulders not long ago. Yeah, so just because the kid did this Monday night doesn't mean he's going to do this forever. So that's, Bob's right. Depth is important. Two, he changes positions, which, because he's a wonderful athlete, and we've seen that happen before. And the final option is he transfers. I can't give you an answer right now. Feinbaum thinks that he's going to...
But not NFL.
No. And Paul Feinbaum thinks that he's kind of going to wait until spring practice to make a determination about his own future. Amazing. Oh, by the way, one other thing about this game, and when you look at this game and put it in some sort of historical context, because you got to look at the last championship game and this game. Think about what happened. Because I can't remember a better walk-off homer to win a football game like this. I mean, Deshaun Watson threw a pass to Hunter Renfrow with 1 second left last year. Hmm. But now on second and forever, this kid throws a pass to Devontae Smith, and he could have run out the tunnel like Flipper Anderson did a million years ago against the Giants. Think about those two endings and tell me if you can remember in college football a better ending than this with a title on the line.
After a sack,
that's it. The juxtaposition of emotion and how you thought the trend of the thing was going. I hate using this word momentum, but because I don't think it exists in the way people think it does. And that's but I know what I was sitting there thinking is that, oh boy, Georgia, oh boy, that well, you're coming out, you're ready to go. One play later, it's over. And I mean. Yeah, that was the great juxtaposition. The way
who would have thought? You know, when Georgia comes out in its opening possession, only gets a field goal, and you think, well, that's it. I mean, they just blew their golden opportunity. Remember, Alabama could have won this thing in regulation if they had a field goal kicker who was steady. Yeah. So they end up in overtime because they miss a field goal. Georgia gets this golden opportunity. They only get a field goal. You figure, well, Alabama comes out. All they got to do, a field goal is a gimme. So this is at least going to go to another round. If they get a touchdown, it's over. And then there's the sack. And you go, my God, they're out of field goal range. They're out of field. They could actually lose this game and not score in overtime. And then a 41-yard touchdown. How do you throw a 41-yard touchdown in overtime when you start in the 25? So it's crazy. So, all right, I think we have dealt with this. We do have some football games coming up this weekend in the NFL. Michael, where would you like to begin on that?
You know,
that?
I go back and forth, Mitch, between going to Philadelphia and wondering what Eagles team we're going to see, or going to Minnesota and the Saints and the Vikings. These are two intriguing games in the NFC. But let's go to Philadelphia. Let's go to Philadelphia because they are the Vikings took their punch early at the quarterback position. But the guy who went down, Sam Bradford, was never going to have the season that Carson Wentz had for the Eagles. And I've been talking to some Eagles fans, friends of mine, over the week, and they think it will be folly for the Eagles to think, oh, Nick Foles is going to go back to being the guy who only threw two picks that 1 year and let him throw the ball around. They're hoping for cold weather and a low-scoring game and somehow, keeping Matt Ryan and Julio Jones and them under control.
They have scored 16 points in their last 9 quarters. That's sobering.
Hmm. Yeah.
That's sobering. Hmm. That you know, and so all the, yeah, now you know they got this motivation thing going. They're the first team since we've had this format to be a 1 seed, to be an underdog at home and to a 6 seed and so forth. but it's for very good reason. And it's really daunting. I mean, the Knowles thing is scary, and I don't know. And meanwhile, they're going up against a team that has kind of reinvented itself in terms of the fact that its defense is now carrying its offense. And its defense has given up a total of average of 17 points a game the last six, while beating such offensive-minded teams as New Orleans, Carolina, and the L.A. Rams. And so, this is a very daunting matchup for the Eagles.
I think I've come to the same conclusions that you did, Bob. And if I'm the Eagles, I am running the ball as much as I possibly can, and I'm shortening the game.
Right.
I'm trying to hang on to possession. I'm going to use Ajayi. I'm going to use LeGarrette Blount. I'm going to make a lot of short passes for Nick Foles. I'm going to try to convert third downs, and I'm going to try to win this thing 12-9. You know, I mean, realistically, Nick Foles, if you're a smart coach, you don't try to turn a zebra into a horse. You know, Nick Foles is not going to have a 300-yard game. And so, you know, I mean, at one point in the Dallas game, he had a quarterback rating of 9. I mean, he's just not going to be that guy. But don't, you know, sleep on the Eagles at home with 2 weeks to prepare for this game either. You know, everybody goes with the team that won last week. And since the Eagles didn't play last week, there's nothing going for them. And everyone says, look how well Atlanta is playing. But Atlanta did have to struggle to get into the playoffs, and they can have a down week as much as they can have an up week. And if I'm the Eagles, I'm shortening the offensive time that Matt Ryan gets, and I'm relying on the defense that did help me win an awful lot of my football games this year. And I don't see this as an Atlanta blowout. In the city of Philadelphia, I see this as being a low scoring
game. And Mitch
game.
And Bob, we did not see big offense from Matt Ryan and the Falcons last week. We did. We saw intermittent bursts of who they used to be. And you know, I had said something the other day. You know that the Falcons are looking like the Falcons again. And you said, nah, they're not really. And the fact is, Mitch, they're not really. Okay. And so if you're the Eagles, here's what you're thinking. Even without Carson Wentz, we could win a 20-13 game. And guess what? And people forget this. Have the NFC Championship game in Philly the next week.
Well,
yeah, that's right.
One thing we always have is always an X factor in any of these games. We should never dismiss. And this is why I love sports, because there's no predictability whatsoever, really, in the end. Special teams, all Philadelphia would need in this scenario of the 12-9 or even the 20-13 would be a defensive touchdown or a key turnover that gives them a short field kind of thing. You know, so that's always a variable. You mentioned one name, Mitch, I believe, that I think is interesting to keep your eye on. LeGarrette Blount is capable of big moments in these games. Mm-hmm. And he could easily turn into a gain anywhere from, you know, 90 to 130 yards, depending on circumstances.
Last time the Falcons lost over the course of the month, only time, was to the Saints. And what did the Saints do to them? They sacked Ryan five times. They chased him around all the time. That's the formula.
You're
that's
right,
it.
Mitch.
That's
you're 100% right. Sack him and run the ball. And when you look at the Falcons, though, think about where they were 7 or 8 weeks ago, Mitch and Bob, and that they would somehow construct a scenario or have a scenario constructed where they would go into this game on the road against the Eagles and basically be a small, at least a small favorite.
Mm. No, it's good. And we've gotten this far without referencing their the last time they played in a playoff game.
Oh, God. Yeah.
I mean, saying that business is not part of the narratives anymore. They seem to have shaken away from that, don't you think?
I want to move on to the Saints-Vikings game because, it's a toss-up, as you said, Michael. I'm looking forward more to this game because these are two teams at full strength.
Yeah.
You know, I hate to see, you know, like, I can't gauge Philly. I mean, Philly, we all know they're walking around with a substitute teacher. Saints are at full strength and coming in full bore like a bull, and Minnesota's just sitting there at home saying, yeah, well, but we won all these games for a reason. Come on. They're the matador. New Orleans is the bull. Drew Brees' play, I've been watching some of the highlights during the course of this week. his eyes are unbelievable. What he can see, the windows that he throws to are so narrow. And you take it for granted because, you know, he's back there, then he throws the ball, and boom, it's in a guy's hands. When you watch it slow down and you see if he waited a half a second more, if he threw it a half a second earlier, they're intercepted. He throws to these little holes. At his age, it's not his body, it's his mind and his eyes that are so valuable. And you see him going in against a team that I get to see twice a year, every year, for the last 30 years. And there is one thing that is always consistent about the Minnesota Vikings: they kill the quarterback. That's just, you know, like certain teams, you know, like Pittsburgh can usually run the ball. Minnesota kills the quarterback. And Breeze against that, this is that old, you know, immovable object, irresistible force, or however it works. I can't wait to see this game.
Mitch,
this is my favorite
Mitch,
one on the weekend.
It's going to be an occasion, and not that we should need it. He's a Super Bowl winning quarterback. Drew Brees basically showed up in the National Football League about the time the touchdown Tom Brady did. Okay, and you know, I used to use this expression when we went to places like the Baseball Encyclopedia to look things up. His page give Mitch in the Pro Football Encyclopedia. His page gives off a beam of light. Okay, 70,000 passing yards. He has nearly thrown 500 touchdown passes in his career, and 480 of those have come with the Saints. And I just think that, and again, I'm not describing this as a last hurrah because he's obviously still Drew Brees, and they found a way to take some of the pressure off his. But I do think that this occasion is a chance to frame the football life that this man has had.
May I ask a question of pertaining to the opposing quarterback? Is this a final exam for Case Keenum?
You mean the Jake Fromm of this game? perhaps.
Yeah, except for the age. I mean, he can't claim that he's new
no,
to the process.
No, but I mean, for this season, in this new role, in this glorified season, in this wonderful season that he's had, that where he saved them in many ways, but still there's a element of doubt and skepticism simply because of who he's always been, and this is going to be the biggest test, the biggest game, responsibility ever given him. I know he's no kid, I understand that, but so I'm saying it's interesting.
But he's the X factor, Bobby. You're right. He's the X factor. If you're looking at everyone else, is sort of, you kind of know what they do in these games. They've been there before. He's an X factor at this level. I hate off weeks when you are a team like Minnesota, which has run so much on momentum and so much on, they can't do this another week, can they? They can't do this another week with Case Keenum. They can't do this another, and they keep doing it, and they keep doing it. And then all of a sudden you're off for a week, and you're just thinking about who you're going to play and all the rest. And then you come out and boom, the lights are bright and there you are. If he does pull it off, if they knock off the Saints, I don't see them losing. I mean, to me, this is the entrance to the Super Bowl for them. I think they can beat Philadelphia or Atlanta at home, especially if they get back to their routine. You know, now we played last week, now we do it again. So to me, I know it's not fair to jump the gun, but to me, this puts them in the Super Bowl if they win this game, and that's how big it is. And on the other hand, you know, a magnificent season that nobody expected could come to an abrupt halt if Case Keenum is more Case Keenum of years past than he is of this
year. Well, do you say the same thing if New Orleans wins?
No, because, well, it depends. If Philadelphia wins, they have to go to Philadelphia,
yeah,
right? Play out in the cold. It's kind of a different game. Yeah. You know, New Orleans is always better in right, controlled conditions. They get to play at home, and I don't know the configurations. If they win, if Philly loses, what's it? And if Philly loses and New Orleans wins, then does Atlanta go to New Orleans?
The Saints are a division winner. The other team's a wild card team.
So yeah, if you say to me, if Atlanta goes down to play New Orleans, yeah, I'd say New Orleans wins. But I can't say that. Whereas if Minnesota wins,
you think either way,
they're playing it. They're going to live at home. They're never taking an airplane.
Do we think the Vikings defense has been a force of nature for so much of this season? Are they? Who would have ever thought I would be asking this question? Are they going to force Breeze to throw the ball and shut down the running game?
Well, whatever the thing about it is, we've seen already and graphically illustrated, is he'll beat you either way. They can beat you either way, and if you force you know, but those running backs are have been great all year. That's a great. That's why we're also surprised, and we're not used to this kind of a New Orleans team that can beat you either way. And yeah, but that'll be interesting.
I think the answer to your question, Michael, is yes. The answer is yes. They're gonna roll the dice on Drew Brees. As great as Drew Brees is, they have a secondary that they think it can match. Remember, somebody has to catch the ball too. It's not just throwing it. And I having watched them play all season, you know, I see them. I live out here. They'll take their chances on harassing the quarterback into bad throws versus saying, you know, go ahead, just run on us. We don't want Drew Brees to we're going to play back and we're going to give you the middle and we're going to let you run on us. They're not going to do that. I think they're going to say, go ahead, try to beat us with your passing game. We know you're Drew Brees, but we're the Vikings and we're good against quarterbacks. That's my bet.
I think this is the most fun game, don't you? I mean, I think that this has, Mitch, don't you think this has the most elements this weekend?
Can't wait for it. I like I said, it's two teams, full strength, full bore, going at one another. Both great stories. Nobody would have said New Orleans, Minnesota as the game you wanted to see at the start of this season in the playoffs.
Right.
Yeah, I don't even know if you would have picked both of those teams to make the playoffs. Would you?
No.
I mean, with Teddy Bridgewater coming back
and
hurt,
Aaron Rodgers is healthy.
Minnesota wasn't.
And Aaron Rodgers looks like he's got maybe one of the best teams he's had in a long. No. All right, Bob, let me ask you this about your team up there in One Life to Live, Foxborough. Bob, has the soap opera subsided? Is it become more or less Kardashian-like? Has order been restored? And once again, Bob, aren't you happy that your Patriots seem to have a cupcake opponent to begin the playoffs?
Their run of good fortune continues in that regard. They've had some remarkably easy paths to victory in the years in which they've had the home field. And this is yet another example. No one on earth outside of Tennessee expects them, thinks they can win the game. To answer your previous question, you know, Brady stiff-armed everything, and predictably, that the troika, the ruling troika of Kraft, Belichick, Brady, issued a joint statement of denial about things. Obvious take. I think none of us would disagree. This, whatever is going on, and I do think something is going on, and there's an issue. It's not an issue for today. It has no bearing on tomorrow's game or any subsequent game they play. It has. It's a story for the future of the New England Patriots, the immediate future of the New England Patriots. It is not for 2018 playoffs. They are. It has no bearing on anything. What does have a bearing for the New England Patriots is health, and they're trying to gain better health. It appears that Chris Hogan may play. That's good. That's a big story for them. It appears that Kyle Van Noy may play. That's important. Brady has been had diminished weapons in the last few weeks, and his performance has has reflected that. He has not played well up to any kind of Tom Brady standards for anywhere from 2 to 4 weeks. But part of that was diminished weapons. But he's going to have apparently more weaponry at his disposal. But as far as the soap opera, Mike, I think something is there. That's clearly the garage. Let me just sum it up in my long-winded answer with this. Think about this. Who was the most organized, prescient, standard of mental excellence among all coaches
Mitch
and executives?
Mitch Albom. Mitch Albom. The answer is Mitch Albom. That would be my answer. Mitch
right.
Albom.
And what is who was but yet who made a trade in haste, a Browns-like move, and basically in one day, from all the odds, all the evidence, calling up one team and getting a less than 100% return on your dollar, far less, for this prized asset of quarterback. Well, that would be Bill Belichick. So there must have been a reason. And there's something going on, yes. And I thought it was well pointed out by Chad Finn of the Boston Globe. There's one person and one person on earth who could answer all our questions, and he's remaining mum, and that is Don Yee. Don Yee, who not only is Tom Brady's agent, oh my God, he's Garoppolo's agent also.
And Bob, Mitch, did you see what Yee said? It sounded in the first fallout after Seth Wickersham's piece, he was a non-denial denial. He said, don't believe everything you read. Right. Okay, well, whatever it was, 10,000, I don't know how many words that piece was, but it wasn't that a classic non-denial denial?
Yeah, I could also say, don't take any wooden nickels, and that's still a truth statement also. I'm looking as you're talking, Bob, about how New England's path to the playoffs, you know, do they always get a gimme? And then it always feels like they get a gimme game, an AFC championship game, and a Super Bowl. It's not quite that. You know, like, okay, last year they started with Houston. Yeah. They clobbered them. Then they played Pittsburgh, which, you know, again, conference championship, but they clobbered them. And then they go to Atlanta and do what they did. The year before, they started one game with Kansas City, beat them, and then lost to Denver. Year before, they started with Baltimore, had to fight their way out of it, then clobbered Indianapolis in the conference championship, went on to beat the Seahawks in the Super Bowl. Year before that, they started with Indy, clobbered them, then lost to the Broncos. You know, it's not quite what we think in our mind, you know, but this year certainly sets up again. It's like, okay, you're going to get through. Your first test is to sort of, you know, stretch your legs. And then your conference championship, once again, is either against Pittsburgh or Denver, or Pittsburgh or Denver. It seems like it's been for a few years. And yeah, and in the years past, it's been Pittsburgh or Denver. And I think it's going to be Pittsburgh again, which, of course, leads us to the last game, Pittsburgh-Jacksonville. I find that this one, when people talk about it, it's like they're almost like trying to talk themselves into this being a really good game. And maybe they do. But Jacksonville was the last team to beat Pittsburgh, and they beat them handily. And yeah, Jacksonville tends to play them tough, but Pittsburgh has been on such a roll lately. And when you really look at these two teams, I don't know, do we expect this to be a 27-24 game, or is Pittsburgh going to handle this pretty easily?
Off of what I saw last weekend, Mitch, and you know how impressed we were with the quarterbacking play. In the Jacksonville-Buffalo game, I think I speak for the group in saying that it might have been the worst quarterbacking play from two teams in one playoff game in modern NFL history. So are the Jaguars capable of duplicating the 30-9 thumping at Heinz Field that they gave the Steelers? The answer is no, they're not, as great as their defense is. And I think that, health obviously is an issue for the Steelers, but I may be dead wrong about this, and we could have some fun with this if Jacksonville rises up this weekend. I still think the Steelers are going to go to the Super Bowl. Yeah, really? I do. I think that they are built to go in and win a game against the Patriots in Foxborough. I think they should have won the game in Pittsburgh. I know you love that call, Mitch, because you love the fact that, you know, I don't know, you have to continue through the ground. I forget what the rule of state
is. You have to survive the ground.
You've got to survive the ground. Bob, isn't that, aren't those words to live by for everybody? Surviving the ground.
Survive the ground, yeah.
It's like one time Charlie Steiner, when he's still working at ESPN, and said that somebody was day to day, and then he looked in the camera and said, "But aren't we all?" I like the Steelers, and if Antonio Brown is able to be Antonio Brown in over the next few weeks, I like him a lot. Yeah, I do, Mitch.
I just want to be able to say for once on the record, Juju Smith-Schuster. I just want to be able to say it. I love it. Yeah. He's turned out to be a fine rookie. Let me just throw one number at you. In the last 5 weeks, Ben Roethlisberger is averaging 325 yards a game passing. Now, he's back on his game. And whatever happened that day is so irrelevant, I think, to what will transpire on Sunday.
And by the way, Mitch and Bob, I'm just reading while we're talking because I'm able to multitask. Antonio Brown was a full participant in practice for the second straight day. So, Mitch, don't you think? I mean, his health may be as big, other than a quarterback, might be as big a factor in these playoffs as anybody's.
Well, if Adam Schefter said it, then I believe it, that he's supposed to be, you know, fully ready to go. And how fast, how healthy, all the rest of it, you'll see when he plays. But there's no holding him back. He will start the game. He'll be out there. And that in and of itself, even if he's not full bore, you got to cover him. You know, you're not going to leave him open, and that changes the defense. So, I'm counting on him being there and being.
But we haven't addressed yet.
Before we talk,
the biggest question in this game, the most important question, the Las Vegas question of the game, is: Will Bortles run for more yards than he passes, or vice versa? That's the biggest.
Put your money down now. All right, before we go to a question about how coaches are hired in the NFL, let me speak to you for a moment, folks, about Freshly. Now, we all live busy lives, and unfortunately, there's not enough hours in the day to get everything done. Freshly is the easiest and most convenient way to eat healthy, no matter what life throws your way. Freshly's team of chefs create all-natural, gluten-free dinners and deliver them fresh to your door. So even if you get stuck at work late, even if it's snowing, you can still come home to a delicious dinner cooked by a chef, and it's already there at your house. No more worrying about having to figure out what's for dinner, especially no mess to clean up afterwards. And frequently with stuff like this, you get instant meals, you kind of get what it sounds like. The great thing about Freshly is that they're healthy. You should try their chicken parmesan. I mean, it tastes like somebody prepared it for you at home. These are healthy meals prepared for chefs by people who want to eat healthy but are just kind of too busy. And the best part about Freshly and the number of comfort meals that they currently have is that they're super healthy. As I mentioned before, they've got buffalo chicken, chicken parmesan, the list goes on. And you can customize your weekly meals from their constantly changing, rotating menu of more than 30 different options. There's no weekly commitment, so you only get deliveries when you want them. Every single meal comes with a detailed and easy-to-read overview of all the ingredients featured in the meal, so you know how healthy it is. There's another better knowing that no matter what happens in your daily life, you got a chef-cooked dinner waiting at home. Check out this week's menu created by Freshly's chefs and get $25 off your first order of six chef-cooked dinners plus free shipping by going to freshly.com/sportsreporters. It always tastes better when you type in sports reporters. You'll feel so relieved to come home to a chef-cooked meal every night. freshly.com/sportsreporters for $25 off your first order.
Well, gentlemen, it's in the NFL, it is firing and hiring season for coaches. And in this league, for a number of years, there has been a policy commonly known as the Rooney Rule, which mandates that teams must interview minority candidates during their hiring process for both head coaching and, correct if I'm wrong, and coordinate and defensive offensive coordinators as well. Am I correct about that? But I'm certainly correct yeah. about the head coaching job. And I want to reference a quote that I've carried in my head for over 50 years from a beloved history teacher named A. Graham Down, who used to talk about things in the following context. Such and such, he said, was honored in the breach rather than the observance. And that is the case with the Rooney Rule to our apparent eyes. Most notably, the ballyhooed hiring of John Gruden in Oakland. And I'll just throw it out there. Do we think the Rooney Rule came into play here with the hiring of John Gruden?
Well, we already heard the terms of the contract for John Gruden before John Gruden was offered the job. Remember that? We were hearing about slices of ownership and pieces of this and the kind of money that he was going to get. And he hadn't technically even been offered the job or announced yet. Now, according to Raiders GM Reggie McKenzie, they interviewed two minority candidates before his hiring was announced. Oakland tight ends coach Bobby Johnson, who was in the building, mm-hmm. right?
Bobby, come here for a second.
Would you be interested in the head coaching job? I just want to know.
So,
yeah.
Nah.
How do you think you would do at it? Okay, thanks for coming in. And also UFC offensive coordinator T. Martin. Teams do this all the time. They find, the local guy, the quick guy. They do a perfunctory interview. But the fact is, the Rooney Rule is set up for this kind of failure. If all it really requires is that you interview people, it's like, look, we've all worked for companies like this. They do the same thing. It's like they post a job. They know who they want for it, but they post a job and they got to make it available for the people in the office to apply for a week. And then you got to go through the exercise of it. And everybody who participates kind of knows the result that they're going to hire who they want to hire anyhow, but you go through the exercise, which makes you wonder, is it worth the exercise? Is the Rooney Rule itself even worth the paper that it's printed on? I still say it's better than nothing, but clearly in cases like this, it's not changing
Mitch,
the way the NFL is constructed.
I agree with you 100%. And has the Rooney Rule ever made a team say, oh, wait a second, we were all wrong to want that guy, we want this guy,
right.
Okay? And the fact is that they're going to hire who they want to hire. Now, Mitch pointed this out to me before the podcast today. There were 8 minority head coaches, including Ron Rivera of Carolina, at the start of the season. Okay. And now Because Marvin Lewis is like Salieri and Amadeus. You, Bobby, you can't kill him. And so Jim Caldwell has lost his job. That's a pretty good percentage, even in a sport where I think it's 67% African-American. But here's something interesting. I think the NFL does as well on this as any major sport, including the NBA. Do you know how many minority managers there are in baseball at this time out of 30 teams? Three. Okay, Dave Roberts, who is the progeny of African American father and a Japanese mother, and two sons of Puerto Rico, Dave Martinez, and Dave Martinez comes from Brooklyn, but he was the son of Puerto Rican parents, and Alex Cora. That's 10% in Major League Baseball. So on balance, you got to say the NFL is doing pretty well in this area.
I got to point out one just to amplify the whole Gruden thing and put a lid on it, and that Mark Davis is out there telling the world that he's been pursuing John Gruden for 6 years. Right. I mean, okay, that's all.
Yeah, and I mean, it's like they say these things and they go, oh, right, the Rooney Rule. We better quick, go get somebody
in
there.
Oh, yeah, of course.
And I feel bad for these guys who get interviewed and don't even have a chance at it. Terrell Austin, the defensive coordinator for the Lions here, who was once considered a hot property for head coaching a year ago, and then the Lions had their miserable season, still a hot prospect for defensive coordinator and just jumped on with Cincinnati. He got technically interviewed for the Lions job. But again, he's in the building. Sit down. He said he just signed on with Cincinnati as a defensive coordinator, so now he's working for Marvin Lewis. And he said, I knew they weren't going to take me seriously. I knew, given what we did and everything like that. But I went and they did the interview anyhow. So the Lions satisfied at least half of what they were supposed to do in the process. And, Mike, honestly, considering how toothless this really is, you almost do have to take your hat off.
Mitch,
that 8 of the positions have just sort of ended, because they have not ended up that way, as you correctly point out, because it's like, we started with not thinking a minority guy could do it, but once we did, because of the Rooney Rule, God, we found Vance Joseph. We found Mike Tomlin. We didn't know Hugh Jackson. We didn't know Todd Bowles. But now that, they either picked these guys because they thought they could do a good job or they didn't. And I think, as you pointed out, Bob, the bigger test is, are these guys getting the jobs at the defensive coordinator and offensive coordinator level? Because that's ultimately where you get hired from. And a more thorough search would reveal how successful the NFL is at doing that.
And again, Mitch, the numbers I just gave you out of baseball to me are pretty interesting, because I hadn't thought about it until I thought about baseball in the context of the Rooney Rule. I think, and I could be wrong with my math, at the start of this season, I think it might have been a dead heat between the NFL and the NBA for minority coaches.
Yeah, and that's pretty weird. It's 75% African-American, and then, an awful lot of people from foreign countries. So, I can't say the NFL is doing badly on its scoreboard, but I can say in the case of John Gruden, this was lip service at best, and that's the case as it is with many others. All right, it is time for our parting shots, and Bob Ryan, please lead us off.
Well, I guess I could say I'm disappointed in Rick Carlisle and, to a lesser extent, Stan Van Gundy. I share their mutual loathing of LeVar Ball, and I decry his ludicrous criticism of Lakers coach Luke Walton. But I expect more from these two coaches than their emotional reaction to the LeVar bombast. Carlisle, an educated man, should know that an ESPN's right hand is not responsible for what the ESPN's left hand is doing in granting airtime to LeVar. Stan Van, just about everyone's favorite NBA coaching interview because of his humor and candor, is similarly in the wrong when he proposes boycotting ESPN in his pre- and post-game dealings. This is analogous to a newspaper advertising boss objecting to a news side story critical of one of his prime advertisers. Look, it happens, and it goes away. I wish people would ignore LeVar as well. But calm down, guys. Luke can take care of himself.
Our intent here is not just to entertain, but to educate as well. So, especially Ryan. Okay, listen up here, Ryan. I wrote about this yesterday at Sports on Earth about the Miami Heat and how sometimes the best stories in sports are hiding in plain sight. The Heat are the best team in the league nobody talks about, with a great coach that hardly anybody ever talks about, and Eric Spoelstra, a guy who's still not 50, has already won nearly 500 games in the big leagues, been to 4 straight finals in his career, and won 2 of them. Over the Heat's last 82 games, a full schedule, their record happens to be 54-28. It is the fourth best in the league over that period behind Golden State, Boston, and the Spurs. And they do this without superstars in a superstar league. Over those 82, by the way, the Heat have been six games better in the standings than the Cavaliers have been. One more thing about the job Spoelstra is doing. The last year he had LeBron, Dwayne Wade, and Chris Bosh, the Heat won 54 games.
With 321 rushes, 85 passes caught, and nearly 2,000 total yards from scrimmage this season, we all know how good a player Le'Veon Bell is. Problem is, Le'Veon knows it too. He was already franchise tagged by the Steelers last year, and they're considering doing it again, and Bell is now saying he might sit out a year or retire if they do. By the way, he's 25. Retiring seems awfully severe, but players hate the franchise tag, even though it guarantees them the average of the top five salaries in the league at that position. Now, we all know pro athletes as free agents want to be the highest paid ever, even for a week. Bell, who gets $12.5 million as a franchise tag player this year, reportedly turned down a contract that would have paid him $30 million a year the first 2 years because he felt he wasn't being, quote, valued enough. Now, I don't like the franchise tag either. It seems like a single freebie card for teams in the salary cap era, and it definitely should not be allowed multiple times for the same player. But Le'Veon Bell might want to remember how fast a running back's career can go in the NFL. Turning down $30 million a year at the running back position is a little like walking away from the throne and the presidency. Asked what the Steelers should do for him this offseason, Bell said, quote, value me. Well, there's value and there's ego. Smartest players know how to navigate both. That's going to wrap it up for this edition of the Sports Reporters Podcast. We appreciate you joining us. If you like what you heard, you can always leave a review, and we enjoy reading that. Tell your friends. They can find it anywhere you find popular podcasts, Apple, iTunes, all the rest. We will be back here on Monday, as we do this every Monday and Friday. There's going to be an awful lot to wrap up on Monday, given this weekend's football, so we're looking forward to that. Thank you for joining us. On behalf of Bob Ryan and Mike Lupica, this is Mitch Albom saying have a terrific weekend.